It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where we have overcast skies. Up here on Signal Hill, it is foggier than ever, although they are claiming 10 miles of visibility at the airport right now. A few minutes ago, they had 3. They also have east winds to 8 and 96% humidity. The Weather Service is calling for rain today, mainly before 1. Mostly cloudy for the rest of the day with a high near 59, south winds to 10. Rain tonight too after 10 p.m., going to about 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. Low around 51 overnight, southeast winds to 10. High near 62 tomorrow with south winds increasing to 20, could gust as high as 30. Coming up on the Midday Report, Kodiak kids are back to school. And the head of the EPA says he completely supports his agency's decision to block the proposed Pebble Mine, even as Alaska sues to have that decision overturned.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Hurricane Idalia has moved into southeast Georgia after making landfall as a powerful Category 3 storm near Keaton Beach, Florida, this morning. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports hundreds of thousands of customers are without power as Florida officials begin to assess the damage.
Hurricane Idalia's storm surge inundated Florida's Gulf Coast from the Big Bend to the Tampa Bay region. Search and rescue teams are now trying to get to people stranded by rising water in Steinhatchee and other largely rural areas near where the hurricane came ashore. Florida Emergency Management Director Kevin Guthrie says it's slow going as crews have to clear down trees and other debris in order to reach the hardest hit communities.
We continue to search, secure, and stabilize areas that we can do that in. Most of what we're doing here in the Big Bend area is initial search.
Guthrie says there are early reports of serious structural damage to homes and businesses. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
Meanwhile, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp says Idalia's moving fast in his state, but he says there are several counties seeing wind gusts of up to 90 miles an hour and several inches of rain is possible before it's over.
There's been a heavy impact in South Georgia with heavy rainfall and heavy winds. I know most of the people across the state of Georgia will not feel the impact of the storm, but for those that were in the line of the storm, it is very hard hitting.
He says flash flooding has downed trees and knocked out power to a half million customers in Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina. A federal judge has found former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani liable for defaming 2 election workers in Georgia. As a member of then-President Trump's legal team in 2020, Giuliani falsely claimed the 2 election workers had committed voter fraud. Sam Greenglass from member station WABE has more.
Giuliani promoted a video supposedly showing mother-daughter election workers Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss pulling a suitcase of ballots from under a table in Atlanta. Investigators determined the claim was false, but Giuliani kept spreading it. Freeman and Moss received death threats. Last month, Giuliani said he'd no longer contest that his claims had been false. Now, a judge has ruled in favor of the election workers by default, citing Giuliani's failure to turn over some evidence, which he disputes. A trial is expected to determine any damages. Giuliani's also facing criminal charges in Georgia over 2020 election interference. For NPR News, I'm Sam Greenglass in Atlanta.
Preliminary closing numbers on Wall Street have green arrows. The Dow is up 38 points. It's up about a tenth of a percent. The Nasdaq is ahead by 75 points. That's up more than a half percent. And the S&P 500 up 17. This is NPR News.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. Kids are back to school in Kodiak. Middle and high school students got their first day on Monday, with elementary kids back yesterday. But as KMXT's Brian Benoit reports, budget cuts over the summer mean school and parent spending look a little different this year.
The Kodiak Island Borough School District was counting on a one-time funding boost approved by the state legislature earlier this year, but then Governor Dunleavy slashed it in half this summer. For Kodiak, that meant the district had to chop about $2 million from its budget. Superintendent Cindy Mika says one of the immediate changes is that parents are expected to buy school supplies for the first time since the pandemic. The district had covered those expenses the last few years through federal funding like COVID relief money.
It was our hope to continue that one more year, but with the cuts that we had to make to our supply budget after the one-time funding was cut, we weren't able to do that this year. And so we did publish our school supply lists and let the parents know that that would be a responsibility for their students.
Some community members, however, have stepped up on social media to purchase supplies and give them to school officials to distribute or give to kids directly. Mika says Kodiak middle and high school students will also notice their classes are a bit bigger this year.
We are trying to go up to our 30 student to one teacher cap that the board's adopted. Even though that's been there for a while, we haven't had to go up to that. Elementary should pretty much stay the same.
Another change is activity fees. For years, parents haven't had to pay the fees that help sports and clubs pay for things like travel, uniforms, and equipment.
During the pandemic, the district paid 100% of those fees with our federal funding. And then this year, we're going to pay 50% of the fees. The parents will pay 50%. And then next year, parents will step up to 100%.
Outside of budget cuts, high school students will see changes to the district's cell phone policy. Teachers are expected to enforce a no cell phone policy during instructional time. The district also has almost 30 new teachers, six of whom are from the Philippines. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Benoit.
The nation's top environmental official says he fully supports his agency's decision to block the proposed Pebble gold and copper mine in salmon-rich Bristol Bay, even as the state has asked the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn that action.
For those communities that rely on the bay for sustenance, we believe that projects must pass a certain test, and Pebble Mine did not pass that test.
Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Michael Regan began a four-day tour of Alaska yesterday, starting in the Bristol Bay village of Igiagig. The EPA in January vetoed the mine proposal, citing concerns with possible impacts on the world's largest sockeye salmon fishery. Last month, the state of Alaska asked the nation's high court to intervene. Regan's emphasis is environmental justice, and he says he wants to be on the ground in Alaska villages to see the environmental challenges and to offer funds made available by infrastructure improvement laws.
Because of the president's vision around investing in America, we have historic legislation with historic resources that now we can begin to match those resources with these decades-long challenges.
Other stops on Regan's trip will be Uktiabik, Fairbanks, Anchorage, and the native village of Eklutna, just north of Anchorage. High prices for groceries, fuel, and just about everything else in Alaska also makes the state a high-value location for drug trafficking. During a discussion yesterday on Talk of Alaska, U.S. Attorney for Alaska Lane Tucker says that drug traffickers charge elevated prices in Alaska communities, allowing them to make far more from a single pill of fentanyl, for instance, than in the lower 48.
For example, in Portland, where a fentanyl pill might sell for $5, and in Anchorage, where it might sell for $15, in Kodiak, it would sell for $100. So when you're looking at anywhere from 3 to 20 times the price per pill, it's a very attractive market.
So many drugs are bought and sold in Alaska that a significant portion of the state has been designated a high-intensity drug trafficking area. That designation allows federal, state, local, and tribal law enforcement to coordinate efforts aimed at disrupting the flow of drugs through the state. In recent years, much of that effort was aimed at stopping methamphetamines, but Tucker says fentanyl is quickly becoming the biggest issue due to its availability and danger.
Meth is still the number one drug that is seized and prosecuted in Alaska. It is rapidly being overtaken by fentanyl. But the reason our office is so focused on fentanyl is that it's poison. 2 milligrams can be a lethal dose. And we have seized millions of doses in Alaska, far more doses than there are people.
An event will be held in Anchorage this weekend from 10 to 6, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, on the downtown Park Strip to remember loved ones who died of overdoses and to provide resources for prevention treatment, including the training in the use of naloxone kits. 2 Bristol Bay residents are spearheading an environmental monitoring program. Mary Hostetter and Bill Kane say their work is a foundation for a guardianship program, which places indigenous-informed values and community experts at the center of monitoring and protecting the land. The project, while still in planning stages, recently won an international award. KDLG's Christina McDermott has the story.
Mary Hostetter says she's noticed continuous environmental change to the land around her home, the village of Igiagig on Lake Iliamna. For example, she says the lake no longer freezes every winter like it did when she was a child, roughly 2 decades ago. And as the growing season lengthens and the land dries out more than it used to, more and more shrubs are encroaching in low-lying, marshy areas, a process called shrubification.
And Igiagig is definitely seeing more shrubification and trees growing. And so how does that impact our traditional foods, especially our berries, our tundra berries?
Hostetter and Bill Kane, both tribal stewards, are developing a program that enables local community members to identify and track environmental changes like these. It's called Indigenous-Led Community-Based Environmental Monitoring. The program, she says, gives agency to tribal communities as they collect data over time, especially in the face of potential developments like mines or road construction.
This provides that baseline data set so that if something were to happen down the road, we could say, you know, we've been monitoring these waters for the past, 20 years, and something changed this year when this happened. So really providing us that agency to show that we can monitor our lands, waters, and spirit relatives, and also provide us that opportunity to back up what we're seeing in our environment.
In the past, Hostetter says, environmental monitoring programs in the region didn't coordinate with tribal communities. Now, the tribal stewards say they see an opportunity to collaborate with outside agencies. Hostetter says their program is guided by an Indigenous Guardians framework. That's based on programs developed by First Nations in Canada. The ultimate goal, she says, is to create an Indigenous Guardians program throughout the Bristol Bay region.
And that means that, these are Indigenous value-guided programs, primarily done by or informed by our Indigenous people who are on the land every single day.
In Indigenous Guardians programs, experts draw from traditional knowledge as well as training to not only monitor the land, but guide the relationship between it and those who use it. The Canadian government provides funding to these programs. There are now 120 throughout Canada, and they create jobs and opportunities for training. Hostetter and Kane say community-based monitoring is a step towards a Guardians program. Kane says the project is still in its planning phase. Currently, the tribal stewards are meeting with representatives in 7 communities around Lake Iliamna and Lake Clark. They're providing resources to help communities build monitoring programs. They're also working with larger institutions like the National Parks Service to develop relationships for long-term federal funding. The program itself is largely funded through the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. Hostetter and Kane say the program will eventually provide job opportunities for land monitoring in each community.
Bringing in the confidence to our people that we can do these jobs, like our ancestors were the original stewards of this land, and we can take back that responsibility and be those people. We are those people, but we can be more fully in these spaces if we're also being able to make a living off of it.
One important project this summer is reestablishing a stream gauge at the mouth of the Quijack River. Kane says the gauge has been dormant since the mid-80s. The gauge is currently collecting rough discharge data as well as temperature information, and it will be giving precise data before the year is over.
So as long as we have that funding in place, we'll have active stream discharge data for the largest watershed in Bristol Bay here. And it's also collecting stream temp data. So this is kind of like the baseline data that we can expand more research efforts off of.
Hostetter and Kane's program recently won an EDGE Prize for Community Resilience. The award highlights projects from rural, indigenous, and traditionally marginalized communities in the Salmon Nation. That's the bioregion stretching from the Yukon to Central California. Going forward, Hostetter and Kane plan to continue to expand their work. They want to study lakefish species, especially as sports fishing grows in popularity, conduct research on wildfires in the region, and bring their work into schools. In Dillingham, I'm Christina McDermott.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has denied a petition to put Southeast Alaska wolves on the endangered species list. It's a blow for the environmental groups seeking the designation, but as KSTK's Sage Smiley reports, the decision seems to vindicate widespread testimony of hunters and wildlife managers in the region.
Southeast Alaska's wolf population could decline in the next 30 years, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. One part of the population located on and around Prince of Wales Island could even die off completely. But that doesn't mean the wolves warrant a place on the federal endangered species list. In late August, Fish and Wildlife denied a petition to list Alexander Archipelago wolves as endangered or threatened. That population includes all of Southeast Alaska. Erin Knoll is an endangered species coordinator with the Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska.
Endangered is the species in danger of extinction throughout all of its range or throughout a significant portion of its range. And then threatened is the species in danger of extinction in the foreseeable future. So it's not just like a little less endangered, it's what does it look like in the future. So for Alexander Archipelago wolf, the service did not find that the species meets the definition of either threatened or endangered.
Fish and Wildlife estimates there are around 2,200 Alexander Archipelago wolves alive today, living mostly in Southeast Alaska, with the remainder in coastal British Columbia. Knoll says Fish and Wildlife's ruling is notable because it's one of the first times the agency has relied heavily on indigenous species knowledge to help inform a decision.
Indigenous knowledge holders played a big role in the information in the species status assessment by helping us fill some pretty big knowledge gaps.
Like where the wolves in the northern part of the region tend to frequent and what they like to eat. It's the third time the agency has declined to list Southeast wolves as endangered, and that denial vindicates the long-standing position of state wildlife managers.
We've always maintained that the populations in Southeast are not endangered, at a risk of going extinct.
Ryan Scott is the acting director for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Division of Wildlife Conservation.
The other extenuating factors, you know, forest practices, other resource uses and climate change that were noted in the petition, we just have not seen that translated to a reduction in wolf numbers.
And Scott says Southeast communities and resource users, quote, overwhelmingly condemned the petition to list Alexander Archipelago wolves as endangered. Tim O'Connor is one. He's the mayor of Craig, a town of about 1,000 people on Prince of Wales Island. Earlier this year, O'Connor signed a petition opposing the designation.
It would have curtailed almost all logging activity in the forest, as well as I believe it would have endangered the ability to subsistence deer hunt and hunt as we do or have for years down here.
O'Connor says he got the sense that the push to list the wolves came from outside the state.
It's just an attempt at somebody from another state trying to regulate Alaska because they destroyed their own backyards and now they want to mess around in ours. I do oppose that kind of opposition.
The Center for Biological Diversity is a national conservation nonprofit and one of the petitioners requesting the wolf population be considered endangered or threatened. Cooper Freeman is a representative for the Alaska chapter. He says the denied petition is a disappointment.
We think that Department of Fish and Game's management objective of 150 to 200 wolves is not sustainable and that their population estimates aren't credible. And we're just absolutely concerned about the state's aggressive push to increase old growth logging on Prince of Wales. And, you know, as threats from old growth logging by the state, unrestricted hunting and trapping and climate change escalate, this is one of the key tools we have to fight for the wolf.
Freeman says his organization is still reviewing the impacts of the decision and doesn't know if they'll appeal or submit another petition in the future. But he says the concern remains. Scott, the state wildlife conservation director, says the denied petition to list southeast wolves won't immediately result in change to the state's management.
But we're always changing. You know, as we learn more, we will adapt our management to better address wolf populations. But as of now, what we're doing is working, and we're not seeing, a decline in wolf numbers based on our current management strategies.
Although the wolves haven't been listed as endangered or threatened now, Noel, the endangered species coordinator with Fish and Wildlife, says petitions do bring to light the issues with declining species and can help prompt conservation and restoration efforts.
Nobody wants a species to be listed as threatened or endangered, right? Like, that's the worst case scenario that we've gotten to there. So what are things that we can do or work with others to stop that from happening?
And she says the decision doesn't bar the wolves from the endangered species list forever. Anyone could petition Fish and Wildlife to list the Alexander Archipelago wolves at any time in the future, and the process would begin again. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
This was a bad year for growing pumpkins, but state record holder Dale Marshall of Anchorage still showed up at the Alaska State Fair on Monday with two colossal gourds. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin has more.
Dale Marshall of Anchorage, holder of the state record for giant pumpkins, rolls up with two colossal gourds on a flatbed. Fair officials and volunteers go gaga. Marty Robb has grown some giant vegetables herself and says Marshall is a pumpkin pioneer in a cold climate more suitable for cabbage.
Definitely. He's brought something. The world watches Dale and what he does with his pumpkin weights because it never should be done this way here.
She breaks off mid-sentence when she sees what Marshall has.
Oh, here. I'm sorry, but that's amazing!
Tension mounts as the pumpkins are gently transferred by heavy equipment.
Who's driving the forklift?
That's Rocky.
Does he get nervous? Oh my God, I'm nervous.
Have Dale look at that pallet. Oh.
As it turns out, the tines on the forklift are too short and the pumpkin tips on its platform. Everyone knows what's at stake if a pumpkin is bumped too hard or, God forbid, dropped. A pumpkin with a crack or hole would be disqualified. Marshall keeps his cool and improvises a solution using lumber. Last year, his record-breaking pumpkin weighed more than 2,100 pounds. Marshall says he knows neither of his 2023 contenders can equal that.
Oh, no. 17 to 19, I'm hoping, right in there.
The scale shows one of Marshall's pumpkins is in that range, nearly 1,900 pounds, but the other is heavier.
Ready? Here.
'23, just like the year, Marshall holds both arms in the air. Pumpkin silver medalist Keith Malone of Chugiak grew a 600-pounder, a personal best. But Malone says second place is as good as it gets for him.
Well, I trust Dale to be here with a big one every year.
Dale Marshall says after the fair, his winning pumpkin will be in his yard in Sand Lake for kids to play on. Then he'll collect the seeds and leave the remains of his giant pumpkin to the moose. Reporting from the State Fairgrounds in Palmer, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Today's KMXT Local News is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. on the web at kodiak.org, and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
The real estate market shows signs of life. I'm Nova Safo with the Marketplace Minute. The National Association of Realtors says pending home sales, that's contracts signed but purchases not yet completed, rose 0.9% last month. The trend suggests more sales could be finalized in the weeks ahead. Hurricane Idalia disrupted some oil and gas production in the Gulf of Mexico. Chevron evacuated three platforms and pipeline operator Kinder Morgan shut down several terminals. Most production appeared unaffected. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo made headlines on the last day of her China trip for saying the country is becoming, quote, uninvestable. No response from the Chinese government, which has pressured foreign firms with raids, fines, and limits to market access. I'm Nova Safo with the Marketplace Minute.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Wednesday. It is the 30th day of August, the year 2023. The sun rose today at 7:05. It will set again at 9:13, giving us 14 hours and 7 minutes of daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 51 seconds compared to yesterday. A record high temperature for this date was 81 degrees, set in 1919. And a record low was 34, set in 1998. Currently 55 degrees under heavily overcast skies up here on Signal Hill. We are swaddled in a rather thick, misty fog. Out at the airport, they are claiming 10 miles of visibility, so your experience may vary. They also have east winds to 8 miles per hour. The Weather Service is calling for south winds to 10 miles per hour, and a likelihood of rain at least until 2 this afternoon. Mostly cloudy skies today with a high near 59. And rain tonight too, mainly after 11 o'clock. Low around 51 tonight with south winds to 10. And that rain's expected to continue until about 11 a.m. tomorrow morning. High near 62 tomorrow. Southeast winds to 15, increasing to 20. Could gust as high as 30 tomorrow. The good news is for Friday and Saturday, partly sunny skies and mostly sunny skies. For Labor Day, just a chance of rain and partly sunny skies. Let's see. Let's check with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with revised Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement number 39, date issued 10 a.m. on August 28th. The following areas will be extended from 6 p.m. Monday, August 28th until further notice. The Duck Bay, Izuit Bay, and Outer Katoy Bay sections of the Afognak District. The following areas will close to commercial salmon fishing at 6 p.m. Tuesday, August 29th. The Anton Larson, Sheratine Bay, Kajuyak Bay, Terror Bay, Spearden Bay, and Zacher Bay sections of the Northwest Kodiak District. There will be a 54-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Wednesday, August 30th to 6 p.m. Friday, September 1st in the following areas. In the Inner Karluk section of the Southwest Kodiak District, the Northwest Afognak and Raspberry Strait sections of the Afognak District, the Mainland District, and the Cape Alatak, Alatak Bay, Mosher Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alatak District. Closed waters will be reduced from noon Wednesday, August 30th until 6 p.m. Friday, September 1st in the following areas. At Karluk Lagoon's exit channel terminus at the ocean shoreline, stream number 255101. As previously announced, the following areas are open to commercial salmon fishing until further notice. The Outer Iakulik, Outer Karluk, Sturgeon, and Halibut Bay sections of the Southwest Kodiak District. The Northwest Kodiak District, except for the Ubiak Bay and Inner Uganic Bay sections, remain closed, and the remaining Inner Bay sections will close at 6 p.m. Tuesday, August 29th. The Northeast Kodiak District, the Eastside Kodiak District, the Humpy Deadman section of the Alatak District, and the Southwest Afognak and Northeast Afognak sections of the Afognak District. Closed waters are expanded until further notice in that portion of the southwest Afognak section of the Afognak District within 1/2 nautical mile of the beach near the stream terminus at Molina Creek, stream number 252105, between 58 degrees 10 north latitude and 58 degrees 11 north latitude. Until further notice, within the Kodiak area, only that portion of the northwest and southwest Kodiak District south of the latitude of Cape Kuliak, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by by purseine gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak Area Salmon Statistical Chart, detailed in commercial salmon fishing regulations. And statistical charts, harvest strategies, and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game Office. And, of course, the most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour record of phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. This is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
We have an incoming tide. Our next high tide here on the east side will be at 2:40 this afternoon and be 8.1 feet. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 3:07 this afternoon and be 14.3 feet. Tide poolers, we do have excellent minus tides tomorrow, 8:55 a.m. in the morning. That will be a minus 1.7 foot tide here on the east side. Over on the west side, your very low tide will happen at 9:31 a.m. and be minus 3.2 feet in Larsen Bay. We do have a gale warning for the Shelikof Strait today. Look for winds raising up to 35 knots from the south this afternoon.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.